Joint Armed Services Committee. I am Senator Mia Costello, one of the co-chairs of the committee, and with me is co-chair Representative Scott Kawasaki. Today is March 22nd, 2018, and it's 11:35 in the morning. Today is a highlight for the legislature because today we receive an update from our military. And before we get started with the agenda, first I want to welcome all of the people who came today and those who are watching online. This is truly an honor to be sharing this room and this time with you this afternoon. Before we get started, I would like to invite the members sitting at the table to introduce yourselves so that those watching online know who you are. Just your name would be fine, and then we'll go ahead and get started with the agenda.
Pete Kelly from Fairbanks.
Senator Coggill from Fairbanks North Pole.
Bill Wilikowski, Stankridge and Jay Bear.
Jim Jones from Fairbanks.
Jerry Beeson-Gino.
Nelson Ngapuk, Anchorage, Alaska, originally from Tunt.
Representative Dan Sadler.
Gabrielle Ledoux, Muldoon and Jay Bear.
Representative Reinbold, Eagle River.
Good morning, Representative Garantar, Anchorage.
Good morning, everyone. Tiffany Zolkowski from Bethel, Alaska, District 38.
Senator Anna McKinnon, Eagle River, Chugiak, and the bases.
And once again, Representative Scott Kawasaki, Fairbanks.
Thank you and welcome. So the agenda this afternoon is for presentations. Each of the presentations will be about 20 minutes, followed by questions of committee members. So we ask that you hold your questions until the end of the presentation just to allow for that to be completed. So with that, welcome Major General Lori Hummel. Appreciate you being here today. Major General Hummel is the Adjutant General of the Alaska National Guard. She is also the Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. General Hummel graduated from the U.S. Military Academy at West Point and became a commissioned as a military intelligence officer, where she began a 30-year active duty career with command and staff positions in the 24th Infantry Division and the 224th Military Intelligence Battalion, serving 6 years in the 18th Airborne Corps. General Hummel returned to West Point as an instructor as the Director of Operations for the 102nd Military Intelligence Battalion in 1995. She also served as the Chief of Operations Intelligence and Director of the Joint Intelligence Support Element for Alaska Command at Elmendorf Air Force Base. General Hummel retired from active duty as a colonel on June 1, 2012, and was called back into service into the National Guard on February 5, 2015. General Hummel, I want to personally thank you for being so accessible to the legislature. I know that any time I've had questions, you've been ready and willing to meet with me, and I do appreciate that. I think today is an opportunity for you to showcase the work that you're doing. And with that, welcome, and please feel free to provide your introductions and presentation.
Thank you, ma'am. Co-Chair Senator Costello and Representative Kawasaki, members of the Alaska Legislature's Joint Armed Services Committee, my esteemed colleagues, and ladies and gentlemen everywhere, thank you for the opportunity for the four commanding officers or their representatives to brief you today on the activities, plans, and future hopes and concerns of the military command serving you here in Alaska. As you're aware, Alaska statute directs the Adjutant General as the official liaison between the state of Alaska and all active military serving in the state. One of my responsibilities then is to coordinate with all components to ensure we have unity of effort on items of importance to our state. From vetting candidates for the next civilian aide to the Secretary of the Army to integrating realistic homeland defense training with domestic emergency responses, there is tremendous benefit to Alaska when the active component and the Alaska organized militia work together seamlessly. So teamwork and a sense of common purpose are the touchstones for your military in Alaska, and there's not a more cohesive team or committed team of commanding officers than the four flag officers here or represented here today. None of the gentlemen need an introduction, but for the sake of protocol, I will provide just a short one. Lieutenant General Kenneth Wilsbach wears three hats. He's the commander of the Alaska region of the North American Aerospace Defense Command. He's the commander of Alaskan Command, which is a joint headquarters that falls under U.S. NORTHCOM, or Northern Command. And he's also commander of the 11th Air Force, which has force structure spread across the state and also in Hawaii and Guam. He's in Australia today, but he's going to be represented by his chief of staff, Colonel Corey Mendenhall. Making his debut at the Joint Armed Services Committee today is Major General Mark O'Neill, who has been the commanding general of USARAC, U.S. Army Alaska, since last July. His headquarters and force structure is split between Joint Base Elmendorf Richardson, or J-Bear, and Fort Wainwright. Rear Admiral Michael McAllister is commander of the 17th U.S. Coast Guard District. He's your neighbor. He's stationed just down the street here in Juneau, but his forces are spread along the coast of Alaska, which I know he'll describe for you. So we four represent different branches and components of the military. We each have different experience and different expertise. We serve in a wide variety of missions, but you'll soon see a lot of examples of how our paths frequently intersect, how our missions mesh, and how we support one another to become the total force. We're especially proud of the ways that the skilled and dedicated men and women that we are privileged to lead work together for the common good of our state and nation. It is invigorating, and it is very rewarding work. Members of the committee, our time is very limited today, so I'd like to move directly to the briefings. And with that, let me ask representing Lieutenant General Wilsbach, Colonel Corey Mendenhall, to come forward.
Thank you, General Humble, for that introduction. Thank you, Representative Kawasaki and Senator Costello and the members of the committee for the opportunity to speak today on behalf of my commander, Lieutenant General Ken Wilsbach. General Wilsbach sends his regards. I talked to him numerous times this week, and he wishes he could have attended in person. He looks forward to this actual meeting every year, but was called away by out of the state by the Chief of Staff of the Air Force. I want to assure you that even though it appears that it's overwhelmingly Army officers here today, other than our Coast Guard Admiral McAllister here, it's probably better to look at me as wearing purple. That's a color that signifies our joint headquarters here. And in our military, in our headquarters, I represent both the United States Army, the United States Marine Corps, the Navy, and the Air Force. I did bring with us our legislative liaison. Some of you may know him, Major Andrew Gray, an F-22 pilot. So if I get stuck on any F-22 questions, Andrew, also known as Light, as his call sign, can help me out here. I know if my commander was here today, he'd want to express his appreciation for your support, as well as the support of the governor, the civic leaders, and the communities to our military living here in Alaska. Additionally, we couldn't execute our day-to-day mission without the exceptional support of the Alaska National Guard, U.S. Army Alaska, U.S. Air Force, U.S. Coast Guard, and our interagency partners. Next slide, please. So I'm going to quickly go over a few of these things here. This brief will highlight several topics we discussed with the Vice President during his visit to our headquarters back in February, and also several CODELs and distinguished visitors to our command since the last time you received the brief. I will discuss where we're at today in the changing environment, briefly highlight what our military men and women and civilian teammates have accomplished in 2017, and provide a look at where we're headed with the military construction and building our capacity and capability to project power and defend the homeland. And then finally, I'll leave you with some key takeaways from our headquarters. Next slide, please. So some of you have seen this and familiar with this slide here, but I think it's important that we emphasize it again, the strategic significance of Alaska to the defense of our nation. Even back in 1935, General Mitchell recognized this. And today, most of the people in the lower 48 view the U.S. from a flat map. I mean, you turn on the news today, and it's still that way. Seems like Alaska is a very small little dot up in the left-hand corner, and most of the media attention goes to the lower 48, pretty much distorting the importance and the size of Alaska in our view. The world is round, and so when we take this globe and we tilt it on the North Pole, putting it center, you can see that Alaska is singularly as close or closer to all major capitals in the Northern Hemisphere. Thus, Alaska provides the U.S. the ability to respond to key locations in the Pacific, Europe, and the Middle East faster than any military base in the lower 48. You can also see from that yellow oval expanding from Anchorage, it takes approximately 9.5 hours of flight time to reach anywhere to the outer ring, and you can see those key locations. Additionally, the importance of Alaska to our nation will continue to grow as the Arctic evolves, and we continue to see increased human activity in the Arctic. Next slide, please. So understanding the Arctic, and we present this to numerous people that come to our headquarters, we see several trends in the Arctic that we watch very closely. Melting ice, competition for natural resources, increase in Russia's military activity, and in China's influence. In the lower left graphic, some of you are very familiar with this, we see the receding sea ice. The outer red boundary shows the summer Arctic ice in 1979, and the white boundary is where the boundary of ice was in 2012. We don't debate why climate change is happening, but we see its effects, and we monitor it very closely. Increase in human activity and interest in the Arctic can lead to more friction and higher probability of human error and conflict. In the upper left graphic, Russia on the right and Canada on the left, and Alaska, sorry for that switch of the map, but to give you the perspective here, the reduced ice is opening sea routes, easing navigation, and increasing commerce with access to resources and tourism. In 2017, the first Chinese research ship sailed through the Northwest Passage from Shanghai to New York, cutting 7 days off the trip if they were sailing through the Suez Canal. Additionally, Russians are turning their northern sea route into a seafaring toll road, charging for contracted icebreaker support. They currently have a 41 icebreaker fleet. This route cuts off about 14,000 miles of transportation distance from Europe to Asia, saving companies considerable amount of money. Back up, please. Additionally, in August of 2017, an ice-breaking natural gas carrier sailed from Norway to South Korea, and it only took it 6.5 days through the passage. In the upper right graphic, it shows many of the overlapping claims in the Arctic. Russia's interest in the Arctic stems from 20% of their GDP generated in the Arctic, compared to just less than 1% for the United States. China continues to show interest in the Arctic with investments in mining companies in Greenland and asserts itself as a near Arctic state. Thankfully, any disputes over the claims have been done diplomatic so far, like my commander briefed last time. But with disputes come potential friction, and that's what we monitor very closely. The lower right graphic depicts a disturbing trend of Russia establishing new and refurbishing 15 Arctic bases that we watch very closely. An expansion of Russian military capabilities and their east coast is a top concern for our commander. DOD objectives in the Arctic remain to ensure security, support safety, and be able to respond to a wide range of challenges and contingencies. To meet these objectives, we must continue to make smart investments in infrastructure and capabilities here in Alaska. Next slide, please. Real briefly on the military footprint, and we like this slide because it really gives a perspective of just how big Alaska is to the lower 48. Today, Department of Defense spends in the state about $1.5 billion per year, and federal spending constitutes about 18% of the total state economy. While the total active force stationed here in Alaska is relatively small. It is significant when you consider the total state population is only just above 700,000. In short, roughly 20% of Alaskans have personal ties to the military, and that's something we're very proud of. Next slide. So a little bit about the Joint Pacific Alaska Range Complex, which we call the J-PARC. It's the largest and absolute best training range in the United States. It's the size of Indiana and six times the size of Nevada test and training area down in Nellis Air Force Base in Nevada that you can see to the left of that map. It hosts year-round exercises and readiness training in air, land, and maritime domains. You can see that little maritime piece that's down there south of J-Bear. It provides us the space to really demonstrate the capabilities of our most advanced military systems, like the fifth generation fighter, the F-22 and the F-35, against a near-peer sophisticated threat and from prying eyes. Continued support to the J-PARC is important to ensure military remains trained and ready. Next slide, please. So key military exercises, our headquarters plans and prepares and executes a host of joint and service-specific exercises, by no means a complete list that you see up here, but I wanted to talk about some of the major exercises for your essay or for your situational awareness. First of all, Vigilant Shield. This is a NORAD, NORTHCOM, down in Colorado Springs, annual Homeland Defense Command Post exercise. We do this normally every September-October timeframe, and we'll do that again coming up this year. And that really synchronizes everything with our higher headquarters and our adjacent headquarters to include Canada. Arctic Edge 18, some of you might have read about this in the paper, in the Juneau paper, and some of the activities that were going on down here with the Coast Guard and the Navy and our headquarters. But a very big exercise. This is the first time we've done this in Alaska. We just completed it on the 12th and the 23rd of March. It'll be a biannual Homeland Defense and DISCA-linked joint interagency exercise, and it went extremely well. We had nearly 1,500 Marines, Special Operation Forces, sailors, and soldiers on the ground from Juneau all the way to Utqiagvik, supporting the exercise in Arctic conditions to validate and refine mission requirements. Additionally, we hosted a DV Day, a Distinguished Visitor Day, from Fairbanks down to Fort Greeley and then out on one of the range complex where we had several members from the Civilian Advisory Board, the CAB, the National Guard, and AFN. Julie Kitna was there, and several GOs from general officers from the lower 48 to include some general officers from the United States Marine Corps. Right now we plan Arctic Edge 20, is already going, the planning's already started, and that'll occur sometime in February or March in 2020. We had United Kingdom, England observers and observers from Canada, so we expect their participation will grow as this exercise matures. Red Flag Alaska, I know most of Alaskans are very familiar with Red Flag Alaska. 14 coalition and international partners participated in three exercises in 2017, and our four exercises are scheduled here in 2018 starting in May. So you'll see an increase of aircraft participation starting in May. And then Northern Edge, which General Wilsbach briefly highlighted this exercise last time he was here. It wasn't executed yet. We executed it about a month after he was here. Northern Edge is a U.S. Pacific Command, that's out of Hawaii, biannual exercise, joint air, land, and sea in the Gulf of Alaska. We had about 6,000 participants that were here, and we expect the same on the next one that's going to occur in Northern Edge 19. We've had a great opportunity. This is a great opportunity for us for community involvement and engagements with the city councils, Alaska tribal communities, and the congressional delegation. So a very good exercise and communication across the board throughout Alaska. These exercises, along with several others, ensure our forces remain ready to respond to challenges and contingencies in the Arctic and defend the homeland and project power when and whenever needed around the globe. Next slide. Operations and events. One of the highlights of the of 2017 was the U.S. Air Force Arctic Security Expedition. We did this back in September, where 16 U.S. Air Force general officers and Senator Sullivan flew to Fairbanks. They held discussions on Arctic awareness and highlighted challenges of operating in the Arctic. From Fairbanks, the expedition flew to Utqiagvik, met with local officials there, held several briefings that included the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Then they flew to Yellowknife and then on to Greenland to meet with local officials and general officers in Greenland and this helped inform what the Air Force is currently working on, their Air Force or their Arctic strategy. The Arctic Maritime Symposium, our headquarters is spearheading an effort to better understand naval operations in the Arctic. We've participated in several events down in the lower 48 to include a recent tabletop exercise here in Juneau with the U.S. Coast Guard and Navy partners to discuss Arctic challenges. And we'll be hosting an Arctic Maritime Symposium in Anchorage this August that will include naval personnel from Norfolk, Virginia. Operation Colony Glacier, I know my commander briefed you on this last time. Just an update from 2017, over 14,000 pounds of debris have been recovered to date, and remains of 37 of the 52 passengers and crew members have been recovered. Great effort, annual joint operation with the Air Force, the U.S. Army, Alaska, and the Alaska National Guard, and we couldn't do this effort without their support. The Alaska Guard flew just over 50 hours in support of this, a huge win, and we're going to kick this off again this June. We'll be back out on the ice. The Rescue Coordination Center, this is another joint military and interagency success so far, has resulted in 22 saved lives since last April. And then Alaska NORAD region alert missions. 24/7 awareness and response capability ready to deter threats. Our alert mission cannot be overstated given strategic locations of Alaska and emergency challenge and the threat in the Arctic. So over the last 11 years, we've had anywhere between 0 and 15 intercepts a year, and we're right now on an average of about 6 intercepts into our airspace. So it'll lead me into this next slide to kind of help you understand a little bit about Alaska NORAD region and its our coalition partner with Canada, which provides early warning and defense to North America. We accomplish through indication and warning processes. We have 15 radar sites depicted in blue around the slide that are our eyes and ears out to our west, followed by airspace control provided by the 176th Air Defense Squadron from the Alaska National Guard, and alert forces from our F-22s there at J-Bear and also out of Eielson, immediate response posture with E-3 AWACS and KC-135 tankers. We positively identify and intercept when required all aircraft that enter in our air identification zone, which we call the ADIS, and that's highlighted in those red lines out to the west. Due to the size of the ADIS, the time distance to intercept and wanting to remain unpredictable to our adversaries, we do not intercept every unknown aircraft that enters into there, but Russia can launch aircraft and enter the ADIS within about 30 to 45 minutes, and you can see that little red dot out to the west, which is Anadar. We watch that very closely. This year, just a side note, this year will mark the 60th anniversary of NORAD, the North American Aerospace Defense Command down in Colorado, and the partnership between the U.S. and Canada. Next slide. So our FY18 military construction, two things I wanted to highlight here, projects that were approved last year. Fort Greely, we're creating a missile field number four, and adding an additional 20 ground-based interceptor missiles at a cost of about $20 million to the project. Additionally, I know you track this very closely, and my commander briefed this last time. Eielson Air Force Base, so far $169 million in F1 and FY18 have been committed and approved for the F-35 bed down there. 54 aircraft will arrive between and still on schedule between 2020 and 2022, making Alaska the only location worldwide with over 100 fifth generation fighters capable of strategic air power throughout the Northern Hemisphere. The bottom line, Department of Defense continues strong investments and capabilities in the infrastructure here in Alaska. Okay, last slide, second to last slide, sorry. This is our takeaway slide. Our commander's number one priority has always been and it will not change the defense of our homeland and our citizens. Our military is the best trained and led equipped force in the world. Second, our relationships with local civil authorities and interagency partners is very strong. The Arctic remains one of the commander's top priorities, and we remain committed to working collaboratively with our allies and partners to promote a balanced approach to improving security in the Arctic. And we talk, in this last one, when we talk about support to our military forces from Alaskans here, we talk about this in the office a lot, and I had to write this down because it was put best by one of our officers there. When he said, when military members and families are assigned to locations, they often refer to that as being, we're posted or stationed in Fort Drum, Nellis Air Force Base, or Korea or Germany. But overwhelmingly, military members posted or stationed in the 49th state always say we live in Alaska. This is because of the great hospitality that we see from our local communities and the state. So that brings me to my last slide. I just want to say on behalf of General Wilsbach and the military members of our families and our families who live in Alaska, we would just like to say thank you. We are very fortunate to receive such great support from Alaskan communities, the governor, and the Alaska delegation, and we look forward to continued partnerships as we work toward future expansion and modernization of our force. Thank you. I look forward to any of your questions.
Thank you, Colonel Mendenhall. Certainly appreciate your overview and especially your final point about us all being family. It's something that General Hummel and I have spoken of also, and so we do welcome you here. Before we open it up for questions from the members, I wanted to mention that we've also been joined by Senator Schauer and Representative Sponholz and Representative Eastman. Thank you for taking time to be here. With that, are there questions from committee members? Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that. Colonel, just curious, you spoke of the future modification expansion of our forces. Anything on the horizon we should be interested in or looking at or making preparations for to it so we can better accommodate that expansion?
Well, thank you for that question. I think right now our biggest one of the things that we have on the horizon is we're looking at King Salmon. I think we have $50 million that are going to be allocated into looking at refurbishing some of the facilities there and taking a look at the airfield. That's one of the key things that we're looking at. And I know my commander is going to go to King Salmon here in the future to take a look at it. The other thing is we have, you know, as Eielson, that's probably one of our key areas that we're putting a lot of focus in with the 54 fighters that are going to be stationed up there, but also the 3,500 people that are going to come to that community. And I know my commander, he talked about that briefly last time. You know, we're maxed out on facilities on base, and so they're looking at options to moving people off base. So a large influx of people into that community up there. Those would be the two big key things that I would probably focus in on.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Colonel Mendenhall. Really appreciate your presentation. And on page 4, when you were talking about some of the Arctic evolution, particularly the climate change piece of it, I just wondered if you had any comments. We were just discussing this on the floor today about what the state of Alaska might do and what the state's role is in terms of defense when we think about what's happening in the Arctic and some of the safety concerns.
I think it would probably be best that if I referred to General Hummel to talk about the state's defense itself. I know we are in very close coordination with General Hummel and her forces, and we're an integral part we work together as an integral part to the defense of Alaska and the homeland. So I think she will probably cover a lot of that, if that's okay. I would like to keep that in for her to answer that question.
Thank you. And I guess you mentioned that Russia has 41 icebreakers in their fleets. Could you give an update on our numbers?
We don't have any icebreakers in our fleet, and I think in our naval fleet. But Admiral McAllister can probably talk a little bit to the Navy or to the U.S. Coast Guard and their capabilities. Obviously, our U.S. Coast Guard is the best in the world, and I know he's prepared to talk about that.
Thank you again, Colonel Mendenhall, for your presentation and for the committee members. We'll go ahead and take a brief at ease while we get prepared for the next set of slides. Thank you.
If I could have just one quick alibi, one thing I do want to talk about is the United States Marine Corps has taken a very hard look at training here in the Arctic. And that's probably another thing that may be of interest to you. And that's why we had 370 Marines plus Marines up here during Arctic Edge last couple weeks. And they were here. Actually, they started coming in as early as February to start taking a look and training in the Arctic. So the Commandant of the Marine Corps has taken a very keen interest in the Arctic, and he wants the Marines to participate up here more. So that's a good thing for all of us. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll take a brief at ease. And please feel free to share with us an update that you have for us today.
Yes, ma'am. Just to kick off things, I just want to my left sits Captain David Proventure, two-time successful company commander out of Fort Wainwright. So I try to achieve a balance between being headquarters out of J-Bear and kind of being grounded with integrating and nesting the efforts that continue on at Wainwright and that continue on at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. So combat decorated warrior that assists me on a daily basis in my command. So Senator Costello, Representative Kawasaki, other senior leaders, distinguished members of the Joint Armed Services Committee, and invited guests. It's an honor to be here today representing over 11,000 teammates of U.S. Army Alaska. I'm proud to be part of such a great team of Arctic Warriors, Department of Army civilians, and their families, whose selfless dedication to duty never ceases to amaze me. I'm equally proud to serve in command here in the great state of Alaska, home of our northernmost combat brigades and supporting forces that truly understand the meaning of Arctic tough. The cover slide of my presentation is a picture of our airborne brigade conducting Spartan Pegasus, a defense support of civil authorities training exercise near Dead Horse last winter, where the temperature on the ground was around minus 60 degrees Fahrenheit. And as you can see, our Arctic tough soldiers are equipped and trained to not just survive, but thrive and succeed even in these extreme conditions. Our soldiers and units are ready to deploy, fight, and win anywhere on the globe. Slide. Our mission is clear. It's to provide trained and ready forces in support of worldwide unified land operations, which includes supporting U.S. Army Pacific Command and U.S. Army Pacific in the Indo-Asia Pacific region. It also consists of being prepared to respond to contingencies right here at home in defense support of civil authorities' role and homeland defense mission. In order to do this mission, there are an array of forces assigned to U.S. Army Alaska that are well supported and backed by the leadership of America's First Corps, headquartered out of Joint Base Lewis-McChord in Washington State, and U.S. Army Pacific in Hawaii out of Fort Shafter. We also have a relationship with Alaskan Command. When it comes to missions with the Alaska Joint Operations Area, we work very closely with the Alaskan Command staff to ensure we are ready to respond to missions in the homeland. The recent exercise Corey made reference to, Arctic Edge, was a great example of how joint operations are conducted to support our role in defending the homeland here in Alaska. The forces assigned to U.S. Army Alaska include our Airborne Brigade, based out of Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, some of whom are currently deployed in support of Operation Freedom Sentinel in Afghanistan, and 1st Striker Brigade, stationed out of Fort Wainwright. Additionally, there is both a support and attack aviation battalion at Fort Wainwright that provides direct support to our formations. We also have a combat service and support battalion who enables us to be ready to meet our nation's call. Our third location is the Northern Warfare Training Center located at Black Rapids near Fort Greely. This is the Army's center of world-class extreme cold weather instruction. In an earlier session this morning, I was highlighting to Governor Walker, the throughput is unbelievable. It is real. I mean, the folks from the lower 48, joint teammates, Army Special Operations Command, their forces are really pushing through, getting some good quality reps up there at Black Rapids. So again, it's a gem. Slide. Readiness is the Army's number one priority. For U.S. Army Alaska, that means trained, combat-ready, dependable, rapidly deployable teams of skilled, tough, and alert, and adaptive warriors. Our warriors act with discipline, initiative, and led by personal example of decisive, adaptive, and flexible leaders. Leaders at all levels who clearly articulate the intent and build trust within their organizations and empower subordinates. Warfighting is our focus. We're employing all the tools and resources provided so we are ready at a moment's notice to engage and destroy the enemy. In short, U.S. Army Alaska is a true Arctic tough team of soldiers and families. We are privileged to live in Alaska and are proud to serve as America's Arctic warriors. We are grateful for the support of our local communities, our local, state, and national leaders, and our dedicated civilian workforce and world-class installations. We stand ready to answer our nation's call anywhere, anytime. Slide. These are my priorities that drive our organization: building readiness, building strong relationships, developing leaders, and strengthening the profession of arms. In a world where the drivers of instability continue to pose a threat to peace and prosperity, being prepared remains our focus. Readiness is and will remain our number one priority. I tell soldiers all the time, we have to live on amber. By that I mean each of us have the responsibility to be personally prepared and aware of our surroundings 24/7, 365 days a year, to train and to master the fundamentals of our profession and seize every opportunity to train as a joint force. To be ready requires us to build strong relationships here in Alaska and beyond. I have charged leaders to get to know everyone they could or would work with in a contingency. Relationships matter. It's always best to go into a situation having already made the connections versus attempting to solve a problem from a cold start in some cold, miserable night. Units cannot succeed without strong leaders. Our ability to operate and succeed is focused on developing leaders at every level, ranging from a five-soldier team to a 3,500-soldier brigade. The training infrastructure available in Alaska, commonly referred to as the Joint Pacific Alaska Range Complex, or simply JPARC, Corey mentioned it and referenced it along with Lori earlier, is unmatched and provides a world-class training environment to build adaptive leaders and ready units. U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan is right when he calls JPARC the crown jewel of the Department of Defense training environment. JPARC also enables us to train as a joint force, as was demonstrated by our recent exercise, Arctic Edge, and with allies and multinational partners. Add to this the Northern Warfare Training Center, where we teach leaders from across the Department of Defense to thrive in the cold and mountainous terrain. Slide. A testament to the quality of our soldiers is how often they are called to duty around the world. While we are assigned to U.S. Pacific Command, our unique capability is sought after in many regions around the globe. The chart shows the places we have deployed over the last several years. You can please refer to the legend up on the top right of the slide. This also highlights some of our major training events and deployments since our last brief to the Joint Armed Services Committee. Some specific accomplishments include our airborne brigade starting the year with Operation Arctic Pegasus, previously highlighted on the lead slide at Dead Horse. This was followed by soldiers from both our brigades participating in Pacific Pathways 17, where our soldiers trained with our allies in countries around the Pacific Rim that include Australia, Singapore, Thailand, and Japan, that continue to build relationships and readiness. During this time, our Airborne Brigade deployed a good portion of their unit to Afghanistan. Our soldiers continue to do important work to train and assist the Afghan security forces to date. Let us all not forget, as we are here today, we have U.S. Army Alaska soldiers deployed in harm's way, protecting our freedoms. Slide. As we look into the future of U.S. Army Alaska in the month of April, a portion of our Airborne Brigade will participate in Joint Warfighter Assessment at Yakima Training Area, Training Grounds in Washington State and at Fort Bliss, Texas. This exercise is an assessment of capabilities and refinement of requirements while looking at the art of the possible for future operations. In May, our 1st Striker Brigade will train with the Canadian Army in an exercise called Maple Resolve. This exercise will help certify the Canadian Army on some of their capabilities, and that exercise will take place at Wainwright, Canada. Our Airborne Brigade, who redeploys early this summer and after a period of well-deserved leave, will pick up a rigorous home station training and readiness glide path to get ready and to be ready. June will bring the yearly exercise Arctic Aurora back to Alaska. This is a bilateral training exercise with the Japanese Ground Self-Defense Force. During the summer months, a portion of the Army Aviation Forces stationed in Alaska will participate in the Pacific Pathways 18, where they will train across the Pacific theaters in countries including Australia, Japan, Thailand, Guam, and in the Philippines. In the fall, we'll conduct Arctic Anvil, which is a major home station training event preparing our 1st Striker Brigade to deploy for a National Training Center rotation scheduled in the spring of 2019. Slide. As you can see, our Arctic warriors are very busy training and always preparing to ensure the safety and protection of our country and its interests. We are blessed to be afforded this great opportunity to train in the great state of Alaska with its unmatched joint training environment and backed by the strong relationships with Alaska and its people. I want to thank you once again for allowing me to talk about our Arctic warriors. Standing by for your questions.
Thank you very much, Major General O'Neill. Appreciate your presentation. Are there questions of committee members? Representative Reinbold.
First of all, thank you all for your service. It's such an honor to be here. I'm sure I'm speaking on behalf of all of us. Thank you for your presentation. What my question to you is, you talked about the number of people deployed. Do you have the number of Alaskans that are deployed and the number that are nationwide deployed at this time, or is that a question appropriate for someone else?
Well, I can get that those numbers to you. I don't have them at the top of the hand. I don't know, Lori, for the collective team. I think we'll probably just get back with it, because I think it will be, I don't want to guess. Okay. But we have folks in harm's way from the state and across all the services.
Representative Reinbold.
And just a second question. Is there any deficiencies? Like you guys say you have the best trained, et cetera, et cetera. We just want to make sure that are there any deficiencies in equipment or training or supplies or anything that you guys are seeking from either the federal government or anything in Alaska?
So we're working through with, you know, kind of by through with our the Army and the senior leadership, because it's a bigger problem than just formation station in Alaska. But what we're looking for is the replacement for the SUSV, basically the support vehicle for the squad. So I know the Army has recognized an operational need statement, and we're kind of going through a procurement process to kind of figure out which is going to be the successor of that program. So that's bigger than an Army problem. It deals across the whole entire joint force. So we're working that. Another challenge that we're continuing to work, right, because we're out here, we're the proponent for the extreme cold weather operations, is protecting our faces, our hands, our feet. So we're working with actually 10th Mountain Division, right, because we both have proponents and responsibilities for mountains and cold weather, and we have, you know, the extreme cold weather portfolio. We're trying to ensure we have kind of one voice so we can go back to the Army, to our senior leaders, and to the joint team and saying, this is the best thing that we can get right now, and then hopefully we can go collectively procure that, get that out to our formations, and then, you know, if there's upgrades that come over the, you know, down the road, they come down the road. So I don't want to say deficiencies, but there are some things that we're trying to go ahead and improve and equip our soldiers so they're better prepared to survive and to thrive in these extreme cold weather environments. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you. Major General O'Neill, what happens following a training exercise? Is there a debriefing process? And can you explain how that works and what lessons you've learned through some of the trainings that you've had recently?
Okay. Yes, ma'am. So every training event, you know, I mean, you go through the preparation phase, you go ahead and certify and validate leaders, you go through the training repetition, and then at the end, the most important thing is you have an after-action review. And it's not so much like you want to break your hand off on each other's back. We really want to focus on some of the shortfalls and those deficiencies. And the most important thing out of a after-action report is how are we going to go ahead and improve and make things better. So that is a cyclic process, and pending what's on the horizon, what our senior leaders' priorities are, clearly I articulated General Mark Milley's 39th Chief of Staff of the Army, number one priority is, you know, readiness, and that's what we're doing and moving out with on this end. So it is a constant cycle, and I'm very passionate about it. It's a very exciting process. So we're bringing in new leaders to Alaska. We're letting them know here are the expectations, here are some of the risks, but then kind of, empower it down to those young, talented non-commissioned officers and junior enlisted to find other ways and creative ways to accomplish the mission. So that's through the whole after-action review process. It's a great cycle.
Thank you. Representative Tarr.
Thank you so much for your presentation. And I just wondered if you could give an update on the runway development issue at J-Bear, if you have any information on that. I think the EIS closed, but I can't recall exactly where we're at in that process and if there's any discussion at the federal level about funding for the project and hopefully funding for the long-term project.
Okay, well, considering the senior mission commander for Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson is Lieutenant General Wilsbach, kind of really default to Corey Mendenhall and his team. If he can make a comment on that, or we can get back with you as we transition.
Thank you very much. Representative Ledoux.
Yes, to begin with, thank you for your presentation and thank you all for your service. So my question is there anything that we in the Alaska legislature can do to help you or support you that you're not getting from us right now?
I don't think so at this point. What I really am grateful for and appreciative are the engagements, and you're kind of pushing on an open door. When we hear that we have, you know, delegations coming through, you know, we're here with open arms and we want to engage. We want to go ahead and show our capabilities and really answer your questions as you engage with, you know, really those young leaders and junior enlisted that are making things happen, that are carrying the heavy weight and that are the foundation of all of our services. So I don't have a list for you, ma'am, but when we have something, I'm not scared to go ahead and bring it up and engage at the appropriate level. So thank you.
Thank you.
Major General O'Neill, thank you for your efforts in fostering those next generation of leaders. We have some here in the room with us today. And again, I appreciate your time, and we will take a brief at ease as we prepare for the next presentation. Services Committee. Next on our agenda is Rear Admiral Michael McAllister, who's the commander of the 17th U.S. Coast Guard District. Welcome. We're thrilled to have you here and look forward to your presentation. Just for members' knowledge, we have passed out a new handout, which will be reviewed in the presentation. So, welcome.
Well, thank you. And thank you, co-chairs and members of the Joint Committee, for the opportunity to be here today. I am honored and privileged to join representatives from ALCOM, USARAC, and particularly the Alaska National Guard in providing you an update. I do want to introduce to my left Lieutenant Yvonne Yang. So when she's not busy keeping me focused and out of trouble, she is actually an expert in fisheries enforcement and fisheries management. And so she helps on an everyday basis to sustain the one of the best managed fisheries programs in the entire country and arguably around the world here in Alaska. So my intention today is to give you just a quick update, briefly go over our missions and where we have Coast Guard people throughout the state, and then focus a little bit on our activities in the Arctic and our international engagement and cooperation, which I think all of which bear upon the national security of our country and Alaska's state interests. So I think most of you probably are aware of the Coast Guard missions. Generally speaking, we try to prevent bad things from happening on or to the water. When despite our best efforts, bad things do happen, we're prepared to respond to those events. So on the prevention side, we include things like commercial vessel safety and security, waterfront facility safety and security, ice navigation, icebreaking, boating safety, and so forth. And what we're probably best known for is on the response side, things like search and rescue, oil and chemical spill response. Here in Alaska, fisheries law enforcement is obviously very significant, border and port security. And a special note on defense operations. Your U.S. Coast Guard is fairly unique in that we are simultaneously and at all times a civil authority that has law enforcement authorities and a military organization under Title 10 of the U.S. Code. And so we conduct defense operations in concert with our partners, and that is a seamless transition from civil to military capabilities. We have about 2,500 Coast Guard members here in the 17th Coast Guard District in Alaska. We have permanent footprint in 11 different locations, and we have four what we call forward operating locations, and those are places where we move assets to during various times of the year for surge operations. As an example, we have a forward operating location in Cold Bay, which is stood up during the height of the crabbing season in the Bering Sea, and that provides rapid search and rescue response. What you don't see here is we are the recipients of a lot of deployed capability from other places around the Coast Guard. For example, today in the Bering Sea, we have one of our newest ships, a national security cutter, the Coast Guard cutter Stratton, conducting fisheries, law enforcement, and commercial fishing vessel safety boardings in the Bering Sea. We have about 4 million square miles of water that we cover. Most of that is the part of the United States exclusive economic zone. And I know you've heard comparisons of Alaska to the rest of the country, but as it is with miles of coastline and other things, we have more exclusive economic zone that we cover in Alaska than all of the rest of the United States combined. And the exclusive economic zone is that area where the United States manages its resources, whether that be oil and gas, minerals, fisheries, and protects its sovereignty. We also have an international boundary, a number of international boundaries, two of them with Canada and an international boundary with Russia, and I'll give you some more details on some of our activities along those borders in just a moment. I mentioned that I would focus a little bit on the Arctic, and our cause for action for having a significant presence in the action is unchanged. The melting ice provides more access to those who would use those opening oceans. So as an example, traffic through the Bering Strait region and the U.S. Arctic is up 140% from 2008 to 2016. I know it's hard to see the graphs, but we did see a small decline in Arctic traffic in 2016 and 2017. A lot of that is related to the decreasing construction that's going on along the Russian Northern Sea Route after they've constructed new both military and civil capabilities along that route to provide to facilitate traffic along the Northern Sea Route. even with those temporary declines, the long-term outlook is for a doubling to four-time increase in traffic, depending on your assumptions on oil and gas extraction, container shipping, and other factors. A few noteworthy events from this recent summer. You can see a photo there of the cruise ship Crystal Serenity. She made her second successful transit through the U.S. Arctic and the Northwest Paths, this time with about 1,400 passengers and crew on board. She was the first large cruise ship to do that. She will not make that transit next year, but the cruise line, as well as many other cruise lines, are building purpose-built vessels for northern cruises, which I think is a good thing. So we'll see smaller ships, but the interest in adventure tourism continues to go up. Colonel Mendenhall, in his remarks, mentioned increased economic activity in the Russian Northern Sea Route, and particularly referenced LNG activity. In the lower left there, you can see a picture of one of the new LNG icebreaking capable carriers that made a record transit through the Northern Sea Route. And if you look at the picture carefully, you'll realize that ship is breaking ice in reverse. It can break ice in both directions. And so one of the outcomes from that is we are likely to see more year-round activity through the Bering Strait, which is of interest to the United States, as a result of Russia's increasing capability to move LNG and other commodities year-round. Research continues at high levels in the Arctic. A lot of this is focused on the outer continental shelf of the United States and other nations, and a lot of nations are preparing to make claims under the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, which allows nations to claim land beyond their exclusive economic zone if they can show a historical tie on the outer continental shelf. And so we see really research vessels from all nations with Arctic interests on a routine basis near Alaska. And lastly, I'll mention we continue to see a lot of governmental activity, and by that I mean a combination of military activity. Lower right-hand corner is a Chinese intelligence collection ship that visited off the coast of Alaska last summer. The Chinese research vessels Wei Long made a cruise, circumnavigated the Arctic, coming through the Bering Strait last year. And so there continues to be nation-state involvement in the U.S. Arctic, which we, of course, pay close attention to. The result of all this is increased Coast Guard demand for things like search and rescue, readiness for oil spill response, and having a sovereign presence, having a presence amongst a law enforcement and military capable organization in the Arctic for much of the year. We mount a fairly sizable Arctic operation each year, and I purposely crossed out the word seasonal at the top because it really is becoming to the point where we have a year-round capability that we can deploy to the Arctic. We do more of it during the open water season, which makes sense because that's when the traffic is there. But that's not to say that we're not able to respond any time of the year. And the handout that we passed out to you was a summary of the 2017 Arctic Shield operation, which is our annual surge op. We do a variety of activities under this operation. Again, it follows that prevention and response model that I started with. So we do training, we do inspections, we do exercises with local communities, we do patrols, and then we also are staged to do search and rescue, oil spill response, science support, and other things. And I'll just note, you know, one statistic off the summary in front of you. We did 20 search and rescue cases, actually 26 cases last year, saving 20 lives. Above the Arctic Circle in the U.S., based out of our forward operating location in Kotzebue. Our logistics is greatly facilitated through the help of our fellow organizations that are represented here, particularly the 11th Air Force, ALCOM, and the Alaska National Guard. As an example, they provide us heavy lift for getting to some of the northern communities, and we lease a hangar in Kotzebue, which has been our our staging point for helicopters for search and rescue and other purposes out of Kotzebue. The yellow dots on this particular graphic are from 2017. They show the communities that we engage in to offer training, to share traditional knowledge, and those sorts of things. We focused in the Bethel and Dillingham area. This year we'll be moving northward to cover the Bering Straits, the Nana, and the Arctic Slope regions, essentially from Nome to Ukiavik. I'll summarize the slide by saying the Coast Guard, the Commandant of the Coast Guard, remains very much committed to providing the right resources to be able to expand into this new operating area for us, and I feel fortunate to get, honestly, many more resources than many of my counterparts in the rest of the Coast Guard do to carry out my missions. And here's just a couple of additional photos from our Arctic operations. We conducted a medevac off the Chinese research ship Zhuai Long, injured crew member, which is in the top left. You can see some photos of some training that we did with local communities on boating safety and oil spill response, some joint training with the Royal Canadian Navy. In the lower right-hand corner, that's a picture from the bridge of the Coast Guard cutter Maple stationed in Sitka. She had to go to the East Coast, and we sent her through the Northwest Pass. She was the first Coast Guard non-icebreaker to make that transit in 60 years. And she actually celebrated the 60-year anniversary of the first time deep draft ships went through the Northwest Pass. It was three Coast Guard ships and a Canadian icebreaker that made that first transit and did many of the soundings that now allow commerce throughout that route. And then we do a number of things on research and development, oil spill technology. We have a dive program, and so you can see a Coast Guard diver with the Coast Guard ensign there in the upper right-hand corner. Next slide. As is the Coast Guard's commitment to making sure I have the resources I need, the Coast Guard is prioritizing Alaska for new capabilities. Many of these are replacements for existing assets that may be 30, 40, or 50 or more years old, but the new capabilities are leaps and bounds ahead of where we are today. So just as an example, at Air Station Kodiak, we'll see new C-130s over the next 2 years, five new aircraft to replace the H models. They have longer range, greater speed, and can be operated more economically. We have two fast response cutters, which have been stationed here in Southeast, and we expect four more in the coming years. Those are great new capability. Significant portion of their time is focused on fisheries management. We have pictured in the middle on the left is an artist's rendition of an offshore patrol cutter, and we expect some of the first of those once produced to come to Kodiak. And those are now in the final stages of going on to contract. We have national security cutters. I mentioned the Coast Guard cutter Stratton is underway today in the Bering Sea. The good news on icebreakers is that the President's budget requests for 2018 and 2019 include money for a replacement icebreaker. We have two icebreakers in the Coast Guard inventory. Sometimes we say one and a half. The half refers, depending on who you're talking to, either the fact that one of them is 50 years old and can't steam for very long without breaking down, and it's very difficult, and most of the parts don't exist anymore. And so that'll be the first one replaced. The other reference to half an icebreaker is we actually only have one heavy icebreaker in inventory. That's the 50-year-old one. We also have a medium icebreaker, the Coast Guard cutter Healy, which routinely patrols the Alaskan waters, primarily in support of science and other types of research. So it's good news on icebreakers, and we look forward to continuing that program. The Coast Guard has gone on record to say that we need six icebreakers in the nation, but you got to start with one, and we're happy to get the President's support to do that. And I'll mention unmanned aerial vehicles. The Coast Guard was provided some money from Congress to kickstart a program to do both shipboard unmanned area vehicles and land-based UAVs, which will be very helpful for us to make sure that we can provide appropriate what we call maritime domain awareness of the Alaskan EEZ. On the international cooperation front, Colonel Mendenhall was, you know, appropriately said the Arctic is an area of potential conflict or potential miscalculation. I would offer to you it's also an area where today we see a fairly high level of cooperation amongst Arctic nations and amongst those nations that have an interest in the Arctic. As an example, for search and rescue, we have near daily cooperation with our counterparts in Russia, Canada, Japan, and other nations to carry out everyday missions. I want to thank again Alaska Command and the U.S. Northern Command for doing a joint exercise with us last year, Arctic Chinook, which was the first joint search and rescue exercise under the new search and rescue agreement under the Arctic Council, where we exercised our ability to take cruise ship passengers off of a stricken ship and provide appropriate care for them and then onward movement to higher level capabilities. On the law enforcement side, we coordinate very closely with our counterparts with the Russian Coast Guard. On the maritime boundary line between the U.S. and Russia, and on illegal, unreported, and under-regulated fisheries. And just to give you an example of how that cooperation has improved fisheries management, in the last 14 months, we've had eight vessels that were suspect between the two nations that required some sort of joint operation. Five of those vessels ultimately were seized, detained, or given violations. And they, just those five vessels alone, accounted for 10,000 tons of fish and crab that was illegally caught. And so that partnership has been very helpful to protect our fisheries. The Coast Guard also manages waterways, both in state waters and federal waters. On the lower right-hand side, you can see a depiction of some ship routing measures, some safe shipping zones that we created, which help ships to avoid conflicts with subsistence fishing activities and staying far enough offshore from a U.S. or from Alaska communities so that if there were an oil spill, we would have time to respond. We actually jointly proposed that scheme to the International Maritime Organization with Russia, so it was a joint proposal. And most of that scheme was accepted in the IMO, and so now will become part of the global framework for managing ship traffic through the Bering Strait. And I know my fellow officers here have talked about assets that are deploying overseas. You have two Coast Guard cutters that are stationed here in Alaska that will be deploying overseas this summer. One of them, the Coast Guard cutter SPAR, will be doing multinational training operations with Japan, South Korea, and potentially other Northern Pacific nations. And then the Coast Guard cutter Alex Haley in Kodiak will be doing a multinational high seas fisheries operations with Canada, Russia, China, South Korea, and did I mention Japan? Forgive me if I repeated that. But those are the nations that cooperate in international fisheries in the North Pacific. Community engagement is a core element of our Coast Guard strategy. All the way from the Arctic to Southeast Alaska, we try to involve communities in maritime safety and security. While we take advantage of some of the traditional knowledge that comes out of some of the Alaska Native communities in particular. And what's that look like? Well, you can see some pictures here. It's things like oil spill training, mass rescue planning and exercises, education on things like cold weather survival, cold water survival, and ice rescue, maritime domain awareness, knowing what's going on in the area, providing Coast Guard briefings to avoid conflicts with subsistence activities. And we're a proud partner in the Kids Don't Float campaign. And just last summer, as an example, we trained 3,000 kids in water safety. So let me finish, if I may, by saying that the Coast Guardsmen here in the 17th Coast Guard District are very proud to serve in Alaska. Because we often work in smaller communities, we find that we are part of the fabric of Alaska and Alaskan communities. And I think, as I've described here, we are postured well to continue that service well into the future. I also want to thank the Joint Armed Services Committee for the support of Coast Guard men and women around the state, as well as our fellow military services. And I'd be happy to entertain any questions that you have.
Thank you, Rear Admiral McAllister, for your presentation. Do any of our public members have a question? Mr. Angapak.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. We all heard today that Arctic has become a center of activity by various nations. I'm just going to ask a very simple question. I think when you look at national security, one of the most important things that can be considered is food security. What has the U.S. Armed Forces done insofar as food security is concerned? And the basis for my question is, food can be used as a weapon in warfare, and has been. We saw that in Bosnian War. We saw that during World War II. And even Sun Tzu, many of you are probably aware of that, saw the significance of defending food resources insofar as nations are concerned. Thank you.
Through the chair, that's a great question, and we often think about our national security in terms of food security, particularly for the coastal communities of Alaska. And so we do a variety of things to ensure food security, things like ensuring that ship routing takes ships outside of subsistence activity areas, that those ships are far enough offshore where if the ship was suddenly stricken, it wouldn't necessarily ground or spill oil, but yet not so far offshore that it becomes more of a safety problem for the ship. We also engage with local communities on things like oil spill response training. We provide, along with our state partners, the Department of Environmental Conservation, we have containers of oil spill response equipment in many communities around the state so that communities can act as their own first response while, you know, the cavalry comes and brings additional equipment and capability with them. And then probably just, if not more importantly, having a presence in the Arctic so that if people are fishing illegally or doing research which is not approved research, or trying to enter our country illegally, that we have the presence there to ensure that we can take the appropriate action to intercept or stop that activity. And that's the importance of having the right capabilities, some of which I described to you here today, to continue to do that in the future on a year-round or nearly year-round basis.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Angapak. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. I appreciate your indulgence, Madam Chair. Admiral McAllister, you can't obviously be involved if you take you too long to get there to be on station. I know you have a major base in Kodiak, but with the increasing operations in the high Arctic, there's been a lot of conversation about the necessity or benefits of having a second port, and I've heard Port Clarence identified as a potential. Could you give us some update as to what the Coast Guard's thinking is on alternate basing of Coast Guard resources in Alaska waters?
Yeah, that's a great question. So most of the assets that we push into the Arctic, particularly during the summer months, are long endurance assets, large cutters, helicopters on the back of those cutters, icebreakers. They can stay underway for 2 or 3 months at a time. And so right now the approach that we're taking is what we call a mobile seasonal presence. We take advantage of places like Nome where we can get stores and provisions and give people an opportunity to get off the ship from time to time. And but in the conversation about new infrastructure, the Coast Guard's position thus far has been, if you build a port, we will use it. But I'm not convinced yet that you need to build a port specifically for the United States Coast Guard north of Dutch Harbor or north of Nome, where we currently do most of our logistics capabilities. That may change in the future, as you know, if those graphs bear out and traffic increases significantly and the risk increases significantly. But today, I do much of what I do using deployable capability that is capable of operating that area without necessarily having to pull into port.
Thank you for the question. I'd like to mention that Representative Parrish joined us a while ago. Welcome. Next, Representative Zolkowski.
Thank you, through the chair. Not so much a question as a comment, just to thank you for coming from Tribal Health and knowing that there are a lot of community partners that partner with the Coast Guard on the Kids Don't Float program, and having such a strong presence in our rural communities is really essential. We really appreciate the Coast Guard's recognition that especially water safety is not just essential in open seas, but also on our large river systems in Alaska. So I just wanted to say thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for those comments. Senator Schauer.
Through the chair, thank you. Admiral, I had a segue for this. I was going to ask about the deepwater port. But our esteemed guests and a few others have already mentioned it. I think the need is going to come, and it may not be just for the Coast Guard, but the U.S. Navy, I know, has been interested, and I think that from a national security perspective, we're going to need that at some point for a lot of reasons. And it segues into other things like food security, economic viability perhaps of taking resources such as gas, oil, et cetera, moving it into different areas. So there's a lot more than just national security along that, but I think that's something that the government needs to be looking at. So the comments have been made, don't need to go there. I have just one other question now because of that, and that would be, you talked about icebreakers. I'm just curious for an opinion. We have 1.5, but how many do you think we need?
Well, through the chair, if you don't mind, I'll address your first comment. And I'm a big fan of potential Navy presence here in the Arctic. The Coast Guard has learned a lot of tough lessons operating in the Arctic, really over the last 150 or so years. We did our first Arctic patrol in 1867, the year that the nation received Alaska from Russia. And we've been doing it almost every year since. There are a lot of tough lessons learned in there, and I know the Navy, you know, right now is doing ICEX, an exercise with submarines, but it's a different set of challenges on the surface, and I encourage and am willing to facilitate, you know, any sort of Navy presence here that the U.S. Navy, Department of Defense, U.S. Northern Command feels is appropriate. On the icebreaker question, our needs are 6 icebreakers, and that would be 3 what we call heavy icebreakers and 3 medium icebreakers. We do work both in Antarctica and the Arctic, and having 6 icebreakers would ensure year-round access to both those locations as well as other places around the globe and appropriate backup, because if an icebreaker gets stuck or breaks down, you have to have another icebreaker to provide, you know, search and rescue or salvage or other capabilities. And so we've gone on record of saying we need a total of 6 for the U.S.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there further questions? I have a question, Admiral McAllister. As you balance your law enforcement and military priorities in addition to search and rescue, how do you budget for those search and rescue operations?
Well, that is a great question. We actually, through the federal budget process, have a different budgeting system than the other military services who are in the Department of Defense. We are in the Department of Homeland Security, and so all of our funding, the vast majority of it, is considered non-defense or non-security funding. So we're not necessarily seeing quite the same level of increases in funding as the other services. We, on any given day, have somewhere between 10 and 20% of our assets committed to the combatant commanders around the globe, but we get about 4% of our budget from the Department of Defense. Our commandant has been, you know, very, very vocal about saying, hey, we have readiness issues that and acquisition issues, speaking of icebreakers as an example, where the nation, you know, in his opinion, would be well served if the Coast Guard were to be able to increase its top line budget. Search and rescue is in all probably the number one mission of the Coast Guard, and so that usually comes off the top in terms of budget priorities. When we determine where we're going to put Coast Guard cutters, it's with search and rescue in mind, and then everything else kind of flows from there as, you know, second or third priority missions. And so we will always hold search and rescue, you know, dear in terms of the prioritization and how those decisions reflect in our footprint.
Representative Reinbold.
Thank you. These are both difficult questions, but I'm going to go ahead and ask two. Just you can go ahead and offer answers if you have them. You may or may not. But speaking of rescue, I know that there was a plane that got pushed down almost into the channel because of a windshield right out here in Juneau, and they had to pull back and go straight up. And I know when I was co-chair also, they couldn't land. We had to do a teleconference. But my question is, are your capabilities for search and rescue, God forbid it ever happened, but if a large jet or anything went in, or if there was a disaster, even with a cruise ship, if you could tell us if you're prepared for that?
So I would tell you that I have the right capabilities. I have the right types of assets. I have the people who are skilled, who can respond. I have good partnerships in place with state agencies, with my Department of Defense and other federal partners, with local organizations. And so it really would be a team effort to respond. That said, I'm in a place where time, speed, and distance is not my friend. I, you know, if we had a cruise ship casualty along the North Slope, as an example, it would be very tough to get there in a timely fashion to meet kind of public expectations for being able to get everybody off of a ship quickly. That's just simply the geography that we have to deal with here. And so, you know, I continue to advocate for the right capacities, the right amount of stuff in the Coast Guard inventory to increase my readiness. But I would tell you that it will be a challenge, and we have found that through our exercises, some of which I described earlier.
Representative Reinbold.
And I'm not sure if that was a need for more resources or not, but I think that's on a lot of Alaskans' mind, and even in the tourism, if we have 2 million people coming up here. I mean, it's something we need to just keep on the radar. The second question was, knowing that we may be getting into a situation with the AKLNG with possibly China, I just want to know, aside from fisheries, which it sounds like she's doing a good job working with China and fisheries, set that aside, but on an international, national security, what is the relationship like with China?
So that's a very broad question, and I won't try to answer on behalf of the federal government. I'll just answer on behalf of the Coast Guard in Alaska, and I would tell you that we see amongst our many missions, including fisheries, including oil spill response, including search and rescue, that spirit of cooperation, even with China. As an example, I mentioned the Coast Guard cutter Alex Haley would be deploying this summer to a high seas fisheries operation. She'll actually carry on board Chinese Coast Guard shipwriters, and they'll be the ones who, if they come across a vessel which is Chinese flag or has Chinese business connections, they have more authority than the U.S. Coast Guard does to enforce laws on their own vessels, and then we'll likely do some joint patrolling with Chinese Coast Guard vessels. So the Chinese have been forward-leaning and cooperative on a variety of maritime issues, including some of those that I've mentioned before.
In all due respect, I said, you know, excluding fisheries. I just really wanted to find a broader, you know, of national issues. But possibly someone else will be able to answer. Thank you.
Thank you. And one final question from Representative Ledoux.
Well,
This isn't really a question, but I lived in Kodiak for over 30 years, and I just wanted to let you know that there probably is not one person in Kodiak who does not have a friend or a relative who has been rescued by the U.S. Coast Guard. And in that community, as well as many, many others, you're heroes.
Thank you.
Thank you. And with that glowing comment, I think we will go ahead and move on to our next presenter, which is General Hummel. But thank you, Rear Admiral McAllister. Greatly appreciate your time and the time that you put into your presentation. So with that, we'll take a brief at ease. Welcome back to the Joint Armed Services Committee. And our final guest is General Hummel. Welcome, General Hummel. And we're missing a few members because of the floor, that session that's happening right now, but that does not indicate the interest in your comments whatsoever. And I really appreciate, again, the time that you spent with my office and also with the legislature. So welcome, and please feel free to provide your presentation.
Thank you, ma'am, to the co-chairs and to the committee. I appreciate being here. For the record, I'm Lori Hummel, your adjutant general. And to my left is my battle buddy, my senior enlisted leader for the Alaska National Guard, Command Chief Master Sergeant Paul Nelson. So together we make your joint command team for the Alaska National Guard. I want to thank you again for the opportunity to discuss with you what your Alaska Organized Militia has done over the past year. And one of my goals as the Adjutant General is to leverage all the capabilities and increase the capacity for all the components of the organized militia, which include the Alaska Army Guard, the Air Guard, the Alaska Naval Militia, and the Alaska State Defense Force. So we'll start with this is our mission, and it's given to us in Alaska Statute 26. But the organized militia portion of the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs is involved in every aspect of these mission statements, from deployments overseas to protect the nation, to responding to catastrophic natural disasters, assisting veterans during their greatest time of need, and mentoring our young people in the Alaska Military Youth Academy. So I know that you've seen this before, but I think it bears repeating, because leading a successful organization begins with establishing a shared vision and common efforts supported by core values. So our vision at DMVA outlines our four major common lines of effort across the entire department. Success in ongoing missions in support of the active component and being ready to go to war is what I mean there by achieving federal mission assurance. Number two, doing all we can within the Department of Defense and Department of Homeland Security, both of which, the nexus within which I work, to promote a viable Arctic strategy. Number three, to increase our emergency management capacity across the state. Number four, to engage with Alaskan communities. So everything we do as an organization within all of our divisions in DMVA directly supports one or more of these lines of effort. And this focus makes us more efficient with our people and our equipment and fiscal resources. So using the photos on the next couple of slides, I want to take a couple of moments to highlight some of the things that we've done since you and I last met. So last year, the C-17 flip made big headlines, and that's when we essentially finalized the reversal of the partnership that we had with the active component and took ownership of the iron, actually took ownership of the C-17 aircraft, which is a first in the entire Air Force. So this year, the big news story for our Air Guard is the arrival of the HC-130J, the Air Force's newest and most capable search and rescue aircraft. There's a photo of it at the top left, and the scent emanating from that photo is the new airplane smell. The upper right is a photo of our civil support team and some National Guard forces that joined us from Washington and from Connecticut, who were participating in an exercise in Valdez just last month. And Real World got a request from the local incident commander to assist in an emergency. There had been a tanker truck that had wrecked and flipped over, and it was leaking diesel close to a salmon stream. And so our soldiers went from exercise and training mode to Real World mode seamlessly and assisted DEC in that. In the bottom middle is a photo of our civil engineers from the 168th Wing housed up at Eielson, and they're conducting their annual training in the country of Latvia, where they were building and repairing infrastructure in a key NATO partner country. So while the civil engineers from the 168th were in Europe, in the upper left photo here, you can see the engineers from our Army Guard continuing to improve the runway at Old Harbor through something called Innovative Readiness Training, or IRT. And IRT is truly a force enabler for Alaska because our military units conduct their federal military training while at the same time executing projects that benefit our local communities. So for legislators, if your districts, if your constituents have questions about this program, again, it's called IRT, Innovative Readiness Training, please contact me, and I will get them to our IRT experts. It is our job to help guide your communities through the application process. In the bottom right corner, you see a photo taken from Exercise Arctic Eagle, and I'm going to talk more about this groundbreaking National Guard-led exercise. And if you remember when I described our four lines of effort, you're going to see that this exercise was a grand slam because it fed all four of those lines of effort. More to follow on that in a minute, but first I want to pass the microphone over to my battle buddy, Command Chief Master Sergeant Nelson, and he's going to update you on how we're working on character development and growing the next generation of leaders through our ethical fitness program. Chief?
Thank you, ma'am. Good afternoon, members of the Joint Armed Services Committee. Thanks for having us here. Over the last 2.5 years, the Alaska National Guard has continued to develop a campaign and an action plan aimed at improving ethical fitness or ethical decision-making skills, as well as exploring the idea of strengthening character among Guard members of all ranks and positions of authority. Our strategic goal involves improving a culture which in turn has a positive impact on unit climate and individual identity of individual National Guard members. The Alaska National Guard remains committed to swiftly addressing specific instances of poor character and unethical behavior using the tools provided to the commanders by military regulation and Alaska statute, specifically the Alaska Code of Military Justice. With regards to professional development, instead of focusing on the symptoms of poor character, the Alaska National Guard is conducting numerous conferences and small group workshops that are specifically designed to address the topic of ethical behavior and improve positive character development among our members. And in fact, our program on ethical behavior and character development has gained national attention. The National Guard Bureau is extremely interested in what we're doing here in our state, and they plan on using it as a best practice around the nation. We've also been working closely with the Department of Army's Center for Army Ethic and Professionalism, or CAPE as it's known, to further operationalize the concept of character development across the total force army. So this leads us to another question: where do we go next? So the Alaska National Guard is committed to fully integrating these concepts into our culture for the long haul. In addition to our continued relationship with CAPE, we're currently planning on working with the Department of the Air Force's Professional Airmen's Center of Excellence, or PACE, to further explore ways to expand and improve our flagship program. In addition to that, I would really quickly, to conclude here, like to also highlight that seated behind us are six members of your Alaska National Guard. As a 33-year veteran and the senior enlisted leader of the Alaska National Guard, these warriors, they fill my heart with pride.
Chief Master Sergeant Paul Nelson, we'd like to take a brief moment to give them a round of applause.
Yes. Perfect. So as you can see, they're diverse in background, but what you don't see are their diversity in thinking and skill sets. They range across numerous career fields to include a pilot, military, police, and law enforcement, personnelists and human resources, medical technicians, and an engineer. They stand with resolve, they stand with commitment of purpose, they are Alaska's sons and daughters, and they truly are your varsity team. Thank you.
Thanks, Chief. I want to move on now and talk about our federal mission assurance line of effort. So the federal portion of the organized militia, the Army and the Air National Guard, continue to train and deploy and operate and return home as part of our federal mission sets. Our operations once again span the globe, from ICEX, happening right now in the Arctic Ocean, to deep freeze in Antarctica, and to conquest in Mongolia and Northern Edge right here at home. And from our previous presentations by my mission partners, a lot of these exercises you saw them talking about, we all work together usually in these exercises. And that's really just a testament to how integrated our total force here is in Alaska. Our cargo aircraft continue to move people and equipment around the world. And last year I joked that we always have more personnel take off than land because U.S. Army Alaska insists on leaving while the plane is in the air. That's still the case, but this year you can see where we distributed 11.5 million pounds of aviation fuel, with a large portion of that going to Lieutenant General Wilsbach's very thirsty jets, who prefer to refuel in midair as opposed to how we do it on the ground. To put that number in perspective, assuming a standard gas automobile gas tank, our 168th wing refueled over 115,000 cars while in flight at 450 miles per hour, if cars could fly. So that's definitely a full-service station. In addition to supporting exercises around the globe, this past year we deployed our soldiers and airmen into harm's way in Southwest Asia, 295 of them, or about 7% of our total force, in support of our nation's security objectives. As always, our Alaska National Guard is not solely a part-time outfit. You can see by the list of 24/7 in-state federal missions that we are working to keep Alaska safe every second of every day. And we'd like to just take a second to thank the co-chairs for sponsoring our Lunch and Learn yesterday, where we talked about our space mission at Clear Air Force Station and our ground-based mid-course defense, the GMD mission out of Fort Greeley. And we would love to come back and do it again next year. As you well know, Alaska is what makes the U.S. an Arctic nation. And to that end, our joint staff continue to ensure that the interests of the National Guard and Alaska are taken into account on Department of Defense working groups charged with crafting policy and identifying requirements for operations in the Arctic. We continue to chair the National Guard Arctic Interest Council, which now has 18 member states, and we are engaged in policy development, legislation, training, equipment procurement, like my mission partner Mark O'Neill talked about the need for a replacement for the SUS-V. We are hot in that conversation, and also sustainment. So another line of effort, our emergency management. So as you know, the Alaska Organized Militia has both federal and state missions, and you can see from the photos just how involved 108 of our personnel were in support of Texas, Florida, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands hurricane rescue and response. Before last hurricane season, the National Guard was the only component of our organized militia to conduct emergency response missions outside of Alaska. But that changed last fall, because in the bottom middle photo, you'll see one of the four Alaska State Defense Force soldiers who deployed to Puerto Rico to operate emergency equipment, communications equipment, alongside our guardsmen. So this is a first ever deployment of state militia into another state to assist in emergencies. So we are really proud of the Alaska State Defense Force and their members. I'll remind all of us, train on a volunteer basis to augment the National Guard in case of emergency around the state. Clearly, I think the steps that we've taken to reorganize and modernize the State Defense Force are really paying dividends. In the upper left photo, you can see one of our soldiers, Sergeant Andrew of Bethel. He's in Queefluck, And we traveled there to recognize the person standing next to him, Sergeant First Class Samuel Jackson's military service. Sergeant Jackson started in the Alaska Territorial Guard, and he ended his service with retirement from the Alaska Army National Guard. This is one of seven retirement ceremonies that we have been conducting around the YK in southwest Alaska, where we determined that there were members of the Guard who retired but did not have a retirement ceremony and were not honored in a fitting way. The bottom left photo is truly a great story. So in the Royal Blue Cusbuck is Major Johnny Evan. And he had previously been discharged from the Guard with no retirement benefits. Well, he thought he might actually have qualified for retirement, and so he contacted us, and our personnel staff went to work. They dug down in the bowels of the files, and they found that he had accumulated enough points to qualify for a traditional reserve retirement. And so they worked tirelessly to update his record. And we got that done, and we held that retirement ceremony at AFN last October. The really great news story is that this happened just prior to his 60th birthday, and you folks who are veterans know that for traditional Guard and Reserves, that is the golden day that you start to draw your retirement benefits. So it was good timing as well. We're continuing to reach out across the state to find all of our former guardsmen and ensure that they receive every award and every benefit that they earned. And as depicted in the bottom right photo, this year was the 61st year of Operation Santa, where we brought a plane load of elves and their associated goodies. This year we went to St. Michael. Well, I stated in the beginning how you would hear references to Exercise Arctic Eagle throughout my talk. Why am I so proud of Arctic Eagle? Because it's a National Guard Bureau-sponsored special focus exercise, and the executive agent for this exercise is the National Guard Arctic Interest Council. And the Alaska National Guard Joint Staff did the heavy lifting to develop it, to resource it, and to execute it. So the exercise recently concluded, and we successfully demonstrated our Guard's ability to conduct a joint interagency, intergovernmental, multinational operation. Who was in the operation? Who exercised with us? 1,227 individuals representing 76 organizations, to include USARAC, to include ALCOM, to include the 17th District U.S. Coast Guard, 14 states, National Guards, and Canada, in an exercise scenario that was based on a foreign radioactive satellite that fell to Earth in Valdez. And I already apologized to the governor this morning about that. But so in our scenario, it crashed and it released toxic chemicals and radioactivity. Simultaneously, in the exercise, we had a cyber attack, and that compromised our communications networks. So you can see how a complex scenario of this scope tests many of our planning and training muscles, along with the abilities of all of our mission partners to work together in an emergency. Last year, I closed my presentation by telling you a hypothetical story of a very bad day in Alaska and all the ways that the men and women of the Alaska National Guard were prepared to respond to it. But this year, I want to leave you with this powerful picture of the hands of Sergeant First Class Jackson from Queeflick, and he's holding his Alaska Territorial Guard Service Medal. Your Alaskans in military service truly live to serve the people of the state and the nation. The spirit of service is in their core. I hope that you have continued confidence in the fitness and the readiness of the men and the women in your Guard, and know that in your greatest time of need, we will fulfill the Guard's motto of always ready, always there. And for the record, I'd also like to state in closing that when I retire from the Army again, I want to join the Coast Guard. ladies and gentlemen, I just call attention to, in front of you, a complimentary thing we call the placemat. On one side, it shows the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, our vision, our core values, our lines of effort, how we're organized, and a little snapshot of all of our state divisions. And then if you flip that puppy over, this is our military side. And so on the left side is Alaska Air National Guard and the platforms that we bring to the fight. And on the right side, the Alaska Army National Guard. There's also information here about the State Defense Force and the Naval Militia. And the Joint Staff, which I'm very proud of, because it's the Joint Staff's job to develop the plans for domestic emergency response. And that, of course, is our mission set for you. Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes our presentation, and we'd be happy to take any questions you have.
Thank you, General Hummel. Appreciate your presentation, and you're forgiven for bragging, because you deserve it. Are there any questions of committee members? Mr. Angapak.
Thank you very much. I thank Rear Admiral McAllister for addressing the readiness of the Coast Guard in boat security insofar as rural Alaska is concerned. However, let's stop to think about the large cities. What would happen insofar as if there's a natural disaster that disables Port of Anchorage, God forbid that happens, or derails transportation on land, is our military prepared to deal with that kind of a natural emergency or other emergency insofar as food security in urban settings are concerned?
Through the chair, Mr. Angapak, thank you for your question, and first of all, thank you for your service as a Vietnam veteran and the brother and son of a veteran. Your question is a good one, and I will tell you that it really goes to the heart of some of what we train and exercise to, and that is restoring critical infrastructure and restoring, if need be, civil order in times of distress, certainly reopening ports and getting the assistance that we need to reopen airports and airfields is critical here. If I could expand a little bit to go back to your previous question to the Admiral, I think that the heart of your question is about food security all across the state. And I believe it was Representative Tarr who also asked a question about, you know, what is the state doing with regard to our Arctic situation and changes in the Arctic. I'm really proud that the Department of Defense is actually a leader in thinking about environmental security. And environmental security is the field of how do environmental situations and changes in the environment, to include changes in the climate, affect stability and security. And so last year, the Alaska National Guard hosted people from 17 different countries, to include the People's Republic of China, who also participated, where all the Pacific region nations came together to talk about how changes in climate and changes in environmental security are affecting their ability to keep their people safe and secure. So I know that went a little bit afield, but I will tell you that in our plans, no matter what the disaster, so we plan for all different kinds of hazards, but the security of food and having enough food and supplies to move forward to the repair state is very important. And so putting my state hat on with our Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, we stress all the time how important it is for each individual Alaskan and every family
to be prepared for disaster. And our website at ready.alaska.gov has a lot of information about how families can be prepared for the worst so that they can, you know, help us to help themselves.
A brief correction, ma'am, Mr. Chairman. I am a veteran, and while I volunteered to go to Vietnam during the Vietnam conflict, U.S. Armed Forces at that point felt that they had other uses for me and stationed me in Europe. Thank you.
Thank you for keeping us on our toes, Mr. Engelbeck. Our final question will be with Representative Sponholz.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I actually just wanted to take a moment to commend you and the Guard effort as a whole for taking leadership when it comes to character and moral leadership. I know that we experienced a dark time for a while in our State Guard, and I am very impressed with the work that has been done, the depth of work that has been done to establish ethical and moral leadership and character as an essential component of service. And I think that it's well reflected in the body of your personnel here today. And I just want to commend you and say I think it's a brighter day today in Alaska's National Guard.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you. With that, I would like to close the meeting. And General Hummel, thank you very much for your presence here today and also for the work that you oversee. And we certainly appreciate all of those efforts. And with that, the Joint Armed Services Committee is adjourned.